All roads lead from Akron, Ohio. Part one, which is actually part two of my interview with Chris Butler of The Waitresses. Next on The Culture Catch.
Much of mine. Keep in mind in your work.
Work, 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 work.
Today's podcast is brought to you by our friends at Ultimate Ears, maker of the finest earbud headphones and headphone technology. Visit them at ultimateears.com.
Goulardi rules.
Goulardi rules?
Well, you know, kind of. I play in a surf band with three other guys from Ohio, Johnny Teagle and...
Wait a minute. John Teagle. Oh, that's right. He lives upstate.
Right. But we used to play a lot more, and we're called Purple Kniff, of course, because we're all from Ohio, and it's an Ohio thing, as you know.
That's right.
You were talking about Kid Leo before. When we were in Tin Huey at the time...
Wait a minute. Let's introduce you properly.
All right. Hey, my name is Chris Butler.
Chris Butler from The Waitresses.
Thank you.
From Tin Huey.
And
from Purple
band.
Kniff. From
Purple
the Numbers
Kniff.
Band.
Yeah.
One of the Akron, true Half-clean. Akron artists.
Oh, thank you.
And all roads lead from Akron.
And That's I can right. honestly say that now because I'm back in Akron part-time, so...
Well, you know, half-time. You can never actually leave.
You can never actually leave, right. You can't get there... Can't get the rubber out of the boy.
Well, we were talking before we turned the mics on about the great radio we had.
Yes.
And Kid Leo, your Kid Leo story.
Well, pre that, I mean, just Fabulous FM. Fabulous AM. I mean, I mic before you. I actually heard Mad Daddy get pulled off the air because he said, and this is in the mid-50s, I guess. Hang loose, Mother Goose, your rag's dripping tomato juice. And pulled them right off. And then, yeah, Ma, what happened to the radio? They're playing violins. And, you know, where's the funky chicken or whatever it is? Yeah.
So great. Where's Thomas when you need him?
Yeah. There was great AM radio in Cleveland and the Akron area. And then when the FM revolution came, we had a station called, I think was that NCR? I think it was WNCR.
And the, you got a couple, just a few years on me. I don't remember that one.
All right, and then they switched call letters to MMS, and it became this powerhouse. And then, you know, there's a natural arc because it was absolutely revolutionary in its programming, as all freeform FM was. And then, you know, gradually they learn that they can make a pile, and it becomes more and more businesslike, and then it becomes the beast instead of. You know, a revolutionary medium. And it got to the point where they had such a stranglehold on the Cleveland listenership market that they wouldn't, you know, they would, we, you know, we anoint Bruce Springsteen, we anoint David Bowie, we anoint this, but we don't anoint, oh, somebody local. We certainly don't anoint Devo. We don't, this Tin Huey thing, don't bother. Which is why I wrote a song called Hump Day, for Tin Huey, because that was a...
Murray, what's his
Murray
name?
Murray Saul.
Murray Saul, the get-down man.
Yes.
Would say it's Friday, it's hump day, gotta get down. Day.
Well, actually, a slight correction, Kid Leo would call his Wednesday shows hump day shows.
Ah.
And my reasoning was, the son of a bitch won't play anybody local, but if I use his catchphrase, maybe I'll get on the air. If it worked, it only worked once, and it didn't work well.
Well, it worked in this. Well, it worked. You guys, Devo helped pave the way for some of the Akron bands. You guys got signed to Warner Brothers.
I know. Yeah. Well, we were.
But
like
I hear what you're
cousins.
Saying with the radio. They would champion all the English bands, Roxy Music,
yes, yes.
Mott the
Well, they were brilliant marketeers. They
yeah.
really knew their market, and I had a fanzine at the time, and I would try to interview all the movers and shakers in Cleveland just to try and, you know, find out what's actually going on. How can I crack this market? And I remember sitting in at Orville's in Kent talking with Murray Saul, And
Chris, you know, there's the bell-shaped curve, Chris, and MMS is right up here at the top of the bell shape, you know. And Chris, you and Tin Healy, you're kind of down here on the fringe, and we don't do the little stuff. We do what's got to be at the top of the bell-shaped curve, you know.
And now all that stuff is gone with the internet, because now it's all about the guys on the long tail.
All about the guys on the fringe. Yeah.
On the fringe.
That's right.
It's niche programming.
That's right.
So people who know you in Tokyo will dig this interview. It doesn't matter that you're not in...
No,
in with Paris Hilton and her crew. Although that would
I'm
be
not.
Fun.
Oh,
well, you may be.
Listen, we're
the
just
the surreal
good
life is calling.
We're just good friends. We're just good friends. Rumors contrary, you know. No. She's a great. You know, she's a misunderstood. She's a great, great woman. I swear.
She has a great rock aesthetic.
What a heifer.
But anyway, you know, I want to get back to the FM thing because,
sure.
You know, we haven't had anyone to really wax poetically about the whole FM revolution, and you. Being in that group of musicians from Akron who were really the Akron sound was made possible through the good graces of the guys from England from Stiff Records.
From Stiff Records,
Dave,
right.
Robinson.
Dave Robinson and Paul Conroy. Yep.
And those guys saw all of this great, incredible music that, you know, Akron, it was our time.
Oh, you know what? Yes, again, but I have to not to deflate this wonderful story. Truth is, they came hunting for Devo, and Devo stalled them. And they said, well, while we're here, what else they got going on? And
then
we grabbed them, and then we said, oh, you know, and Liam Sternberg, of course, should not and could not be, shouldn't be left out of this conversation.
Right.
Because he definitely buttonholed those guys and said, look, listen. And they, you know, they had a laugh, and they liked what we did, and they put out a Stiff compilation called the Akron, Shine On America is what it was officially called. And
with
you know,
the
it did okay in England.
Sniff rubber.
With a Scratch and Stiff rubber cover, right? which is actually worth a
I still
fortune.
Have mine.
So do I.
Yeah.
I don't know how much Sniffy's left, but
anyway. And then the Bowling Balls from Hell albums.
That's right. And that's Clone Records, and that's the Mr. also props to props where they should go.
Nicholas.
Dick Nicholas, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. Just saw him the other night exactly.
Bizarros. Who were signed Bizarros. Were they signed to Mercury? The Bizarros?
That one? Mercury, a subdivision of Mercury called Blank, I believe, which was run by Cliff Bernstein. Now Cliff Bernstein went on with his partner Pete Mensch to form Q Prime, huge management
Red
company.
Hot Chili Peppers,
you name them, AC/DC,
everyone,
and Waitresses, and now to complete the circle, the Black Keys from
Akron,
Ohio.
Yeah. Go figure.
Small world.
And Ralph's nephew.
And Ralph Carney. Ralph Carney from Tin Huey and Tom Waits.
Why don't you tell us how Tin Huey started? Because, you know, I met Harvey as a young, I must have been in junior high. And I'd go out to the record store at the mall, Summit Mall, and Harvey ran the record label.
Yep.
And he was the guy that got all the cool imports in England.
He was the guy when you came in and you wanted Elton John, he steered you toward Velvets.
Exactly.
He's the one who said, no, you don't want that. You want Soft Machine 3. You want Matching Mall. Exactly. Tin Huey was extant before my arrival. For 35 years, I was the new boy. In Tin Huey. So Tin Huey, I think, existed 73, 74, something like that. I got drafted 79.
Well, you were playing with the Numbers Band.
I was playing
then?
With the Numbers Band, and we would be either upstairs and or downstairs, and like on a Tuesday night, Tin Huey would play. And I would take a break, and we would go upstairs. I would go upstairs and see, or downstairs and see this amazing little squirrely little art band, and that played music that nobody else played, and they turned me on to all kinds of this English eccentric stuff. I knew I knew who Soft Machine were, but I didn't know there was this whole subgenre of Canterbury rock musicians and all this krautrock rock stuff, and that's what Tin Huey loved, and that's what they kind of aped, mixed in with Ornette Coleman and all this other stuff that I loved via Terry Hind in the Numbers Band, who was Mr. Jazz. And so
Terry being Chrissy's older brother.
Right. Yep.
That band is still together for you listeners out there.
Yep.
Chris and I have always championed their cause.
Oh man, They still kill.
15-60-75 is the proper name,
yep.
And the nickname is the Numbers Band.
The Numbers Band,
and
great website.
And it's 1-3-5. It's a blues progression.
That's right. That's right. They have reissued in various forms a absolute seminal Cleveland area, Akron area album called Jimmy Bell Is Still in Town that is a live recording of them opening for the first tour of Bob Marley and the Wailers in America, and it kills. It is still as every bit as fresh and interesting to my ears as
anything you've ever
as
heard.
Anything I've ever heard.
Yeah, David Thomas got it re-released on a label in the UK.
Yep.
It got released here in the States. It's absolutely true. It's one of my favorite iPod listens to this day.
Right. If you take blues and you bend it, bend it through Ornette and through Miles and through, Little Richard and Son House. But also he does a lot. You know, Kidney's influences are huge, and through a little bit of little kind of left turn to Bob Dylan or something, and you put all this free and plus. Terry Hines, extensive knowledge and skill as a freeform jazz musician.
Charles Gale.
It's
incredible stuff.
It's incredible.
We're going to have Bob on. I promised him next time I got to
Akron. That would be brilliant. Brilliant.
And the website, thenumbersband.com, they play every weekend somewhere in Northeast Ohio.
Yeah, they're still working.
And Bob and Jack have done gigs with David over in England.
Yep.
Whenever David's done some things at
and
festivals.
Toured Holland and all that. Again, they have subsets as well.
But here's the thing: you were drumming with those guys.
No, bass.
Oh, you're playing bass. I'm sorry, you're playing bass. Anton was playing drums.
Nope, close. Dave Robinson.
Who was playing? When did Anton play with them?
Anton played with.
And we're talking Anton Fear.
Anton Fear played with Per Ubu. Played with Peter Loeffner. Played with something called Wolves with Adele Bertai, two girls from Chai Pig, Sue Schmidt and Debbie Smith, and Chrissy Hynde, I believe.
Really?
I think in that same milieu. I think so. Anton was like drummer about town. Styrene Money Band. Right?
I thought he did a short stint in the Numbers Band.
You know, he might have. They changed personnel.
Yeah.
Left and right. I mean, I went through it. Jerry Casale, Jerry Devo went through it. It was quite a proving ground. And Bob was, Bob had a fixed idea of what he wanted. And we're young and snotty, and we know better. So we bucked him until we decided to bolt and or got fired. And then, it takes 20 years to realize that he was right. And then you go back and with your, tail between your legs and say, can you be my friend again, Bob? And he goes, sure. So we're on good terms. I love him. He's fabulous.
Yeah, he really is. But anyway, so you go from there.
I go from knocking around actually in a couple bands in Kent, one of which was called City Lights that had Jack Kidney. It was like the Numbers Band farm team, AAA, because Jack was like learning his stuff. Younger brother, and just brilliant. Brilliant musician, he is the best harmonica player I have ever heard and will ever hear.
Tone is
this
exceptional,
and his range of note. I mean, he does Bird, Coltrane, whatever. He's from that school. He goes to Planet Jack and comes back with a solo. It's incredible.
Yeah.
He is the best harp player.
Yeah, I agree. I truly agree.
Just genius.
You're doing your thing with these guys.
Yeah, and then I always, I would go down and shake maracas with the Numbers Band and a bunch of other pickup bands and whatever. And I got a call, but they needed a bass player, and I was playing guitar, and I didn't know whether I could do it.
Everyone always needs a good bass player, right? And you either start out as a tuba player who becomes a bass
that's
player,
right? That's right.
Or
the dumbest
guitarist.
Guy in the band, like, oh, I can handle. He's already got four strings. I can do that.
Frustrated guitarist becomes a bass player.
Yeah, right.
Well, you happen to be a very good guitarist as well, so frustrated to be. You just needed a bass player.
I welcomed the change, and I had a really great bass. But I know where it is. In fact, it's right around the corner on 81st Street. My lovely bass.
What do you mean?
Well, Pete Coleman, I had to sell it years ago, and the bass I got was in lieu of rent from Tom Chris, the original bass player from the James Gang. There was a big old house called Rock City in Kent, and it was like 18 rooms. It was owned by the state. Rent was like $60. So everybody's rent was like $350 or something. He could not come up with you know, the small monitor around. He says, Chris, you want a bass instead? I go, sure. And it was a Gibson Thunderbird. And I wish I still had it. I ran out of, you know, I was skit maybe 10, 15 years ago. And my friend Pete Coleman, Peter Stuart Cohen, I sold it to him, and he lives right around the corner here at 81st Street.
So. Right. We all have those stories. Every
yes,
musician
yeah,
has
the
a
gear
story.
That got away. Oh, it breaks my heart.
Yeah,
never sell gear.
My Fender Princeton. Never. Why
oh,
did
man.
I sell my
oh,
Fender
man.
Princeton?
Never sell gear.
Yeah.
A 59 or 56, I forget. Les Paul Jr. with a P90. You know, bought it for 50.
And they're worth
25. Sold it for 35. Euros. Yeah, yeah. Sold it for 35. Figured, I'll eat the loss. Yeah, it's now it's worth $3,000.
Yeah, God.
You know, I mean, Jesus Christ.
Is there musicians who are listening to this, if you have a Cherry guitar,
oh, man,
do not,
you do not sell.
Sell that or your amp.
Yeah, don't sell it. Don't sell gear, period. I don't care. I don't care if you got to eat ramen. I don't care if you got to eat cat food for a week, you know, or a month or a year. Do not sell gear.
Yeah.
Period.
Yeah.
It'll, you know, you will rue the day.
Maybe you barter and you trade gear because you're tired of it.
Temporary loan, yes.
Yeah, a temporary loan. That's a good one.
Yeah,
I like
temporary
that.
Temporary loan.
So anyway, you get the call. You see these guys. You've noodled around with these other bands.
Yeah.
Tin Huey's looking for.
Well, Numbers Band 3 years. Began to write songs on my own. Hooked back up with Liam Sternberg.
Now tell people who Liam, what his whole thing was.
Okay,
and how
Liam.
He enters
Liam.
In the equation.
I first met Liam in 1970. He was a guitar player. He kind of disappeared for a while. He was importing American guitars into England. And God knows what else he was doing. I hooked back up with him 75, 76, 77, somewhere in there. He had a friend in Akron, had a friend in Akron called Rick Daly who had an 8-track machine and two matching Neumann microphones. You cannot underestimate the power of Rick Daly on, in terms of our recording. In fact, I just saw Rick Daly last Sunday singing in the chorus for Canton Symphony's Beethoven 9th.
Wow.
Which was fabulous. Liam Sternberg, whatever. Long story with Liam. Anyway, really good.
He was a music enthusiast. He was an impresario of Akron in some ways.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. We both were playing in other groups that didn't allow us much time, so the solution was, we'll invent some fake bands. Yeah, good idea. My fake band was called The Waitresses, and his fake band was called Jane Eyre and the Belvederes.
You know what? I had not thought of Jane Eyre and the Belvederes
until
you just now mentioned
them.
They were
Yankee
fantastic.
Wheels. Yankee Wheel. In fact, my friend Amy Rigby loves to cover Yankee Wheels, which was a song I played bass on and recorded at Rick Daly's basement with Liam's Corolla, Toyota Corolla, as the motorcycle rev engine sound because it had a blown muffler. They did a couple of albums for Stiff. She married a Boomtown rat, then unmarried a Boomtown rat. I think she's back in Akron Canton area.
I don't know. I don't know what happened to her, but I remember she did a couple of records. Yeah.
Yep. The interesting thing about the Akron-Cleveland area is that neither of them really had huge scenes. The scene was in Kent because you had a strip where there were 8 or 9 clubs, all of which required. And it may be in a genre, but you were the audience wanted you to write and or play original music. Now, that is completely opposite you know, the way the rest of the music business is anywhere else in the world. You know, you're a cover band. You do, cover songs, hits of the day, whatever. The audience there wanted to hear something different, and they forced you to write. And so you.
Why do you think that? Is that because Kent was always a big art school?
Maybe art school.
And it was,
maybe
far enough away from Akron and Cleveland, it had its. You know, you weren't going to get anywhere else.
Could maybe. You know, I don't. You know what? I don't know. It's one of those great freaks of popular culture nature. It's certainly not like that now. It was a bubble, but if you had any inkling to write a song, you could do it there and or perform it there, and it is such a rare thing in the music business. Well, that's what Liam began to do, and that's what I began to do. But we had these fake bands to quote perform them. which involved getting a lot of the people who were on the Akron compilation, you know, to play various instruments on our in our fake bands. And Liam, just to wrap it back up, Liam kind of glommed onto the Stiff Record guys when they showed up and was spirited away to London, where he stayed for, I think, easily 10-some years. Well, now, for Stiff.
Let's talk about Stiff just as a sidebar, because in those days, Stiff Records really championed a lot of the alternative music. You had the punk scene happening, but Stiff decided to go a little bit
even more
out and bizarre and alternative.
And they looked for writers. They looked for hits. Punk, of course, you know, supposedly was anti-hit. But the genius of Stiff was a manifold. But one of them was they were able to find writers who could write within a raw sounding, genre or whatever. You could record it on the cheap with 8-track machine, so it sounded rough and tumble. And they had funny names like Elvis Costello, or
Restless Eric,
yeah. Who I just have become mates. I've become mates with Restless.
Have you really?
Reckless
Ian
Eric.
Drury as well, right?
Huh?
Was Ian Drury?
Ian Drury, yeah. Exactly. You know,
I mean,
all
what
these
kind of
oddballs.
Yeah, they just didn't.
These brilliant oddballs that didn't fit in with any
anywhere
mainstream.
Else.
That, yeah, and they wrote and they played. Obviously, you all know the name. So.
Right.
Nick Lowe, just fabulous stuff. They all went through Stiff, and Stiff was incredibly influential graphically, attitudinally. They looked like a punk label, but they were much more sarcastic and or mainstream, because it was run by two unbelievably great, a.k.a. scummy, a.k.a. swarmy music business hustlers, Dave Robinson and Paul Conroy. And they were brilliant. Their joke was, you know, sign them on Friday, record them on Saturday, release it on Sunday, delete it on Monday. You know, and they just churned catalog and, you know, and their answer was, we want to sign one right with the record house. It's great, you know, and then the artists would go, but we need a contract. Ah, you know what, you write the contract, I'll sign it whatever you want. Which is what they would do. You would give them a contract, and they would sign. And, the reason why they said, "What the hell?" is they had no intention of honoring anything.
good luck seeing them in court and collecting.
Right. Whatever whatever you wrote. Sure, you know. Of course. Well, you know. Let's don't get the papers get in the way of having us hits and success. You know.
And they had a funky old warehouse office.
And then of course they made a deal in America with Columbia for X amount of records, and they tried to kind of mainstream themselves, and I don't know, it didn't kind of really work, but
karma caught up with them. But the point
everybody stood up, but then they left town, so like
they found great music.
They found great music,
and they launched careers.
As I said, I'm still Nick Lowe.
Yeah, all those guys. I mean, that's
great writers, great songwriters. They
come into town.
They come into town. They were over at Mark Price's house.
And Mark was in Tin Huey for those listening.
Yeah, bass player for Tin Huey. And he had the other 8-track in town. He had an Atari supposedly incompatible with the 80-8 that Rick Daly had, but we didn't care. You know, +10. Or +4 -10 BFD, which is run the tapes back and forth. You know, one had DBX noise reduction, the other had Dolby noise reduction. Big deal.
It lends to the sound.
Yeah, lends to the sound, right? That nice high upper mid emphasis. So Dave Robinson's sitting in the studio area. He listens to 10 seconds of something. B side, 10 seconds. Hit. Yeah, just running through. We played him everything, showing him our little precious darlings, showing the big record guy precious darlings. And that's when he got the idea of, Akron compilation, and Liam was the executive organizer, and Liam got spirited away because Liam was very good at working the room, shall we say. And Liam was like doing staff work at Stiff and also other production stuff. So that's Liam and that's Stiff. Stiff, as I said, they continued to do really, really well until they didn't, like most things in the record business. But, Dave Robinson, I'm sure is quite comfortable. And Paul Conroy is now, Virgin? V2? I forget. Anyway, big muckety muck.
Right. So, Tin Huey.
Tin Huey.
Tin Huey comes, rises out of this
Tin Huey
cacophony.
Rises out of the murk. Tin Huey, weird little art band. I get fired from the numbers band.
Too much moonlighting with other projects.
I skipped out on a rehearsal to get my picture taken for my fake band for the back of the Akron compilation. And that's unconscionable, and was voted out. Bang, boom, and I
And the
swear.
Shame of it that was, Chris, though, is the numbers band got left out of the scene completely.
Well, that...
Was that by design, or was that by accident, or was that a combination
That was
of-
by fate. That was also by, not from lack of everybody and their mother trying. When Jerry Wexler came to... I'm jumping ahead, but when Jerry Wexler came to look at Tin Huey, demanded
those,
that
Jerry,
he go down...
Let's talk about Jerry Wexler.
Okay.
Very famous... Producer,
yes.
Aretha Franklin,
yes.
You name
Shoals,
anyone from Atlantic Records.
Came up with the phrase "rhythm and blues" when he was a writer for Billboard back in the 40s.
So for
40s.
Jerry Wexler to be in town to check anyone out,
is big deal.
Is a coup. That's like dying going to heaven. That's manna from heaven.
Yeah, because I brought a couple of my records that he had worked on and produced for them, autograph, and we all said you must get your ass down to see. Respectfully, Mr. Wexler, get your respectful ass down to see this incredible R&B band that you will love. And he refused.
Ugh.
He didn't go. And that was a heartbreaker. No, numbers band, their fates, there's different, and this is not intellectual backpedaling or coping with. There are various ways you have to define success. And the fact that they're rowing along, the fact that they have their dignity, the fact that they're friggin' brilliant.
They've never sold out.
They never sold out, but the turnaround of that is, my line is I've been trying to sell out for years, but nobody's buying. So them nobody bought. I can't say that them not being scarfed up, and chewed up and then spit out wasn't such a bad thing.
Right.
It's no fun to be part of that industry.
Well, you've had when Tin Huey hit.
Okay, Tin Huey. So, Tin Huey, I'm backtracking here. I am kicked out of the numbers band 2 weeks, 3 weeks, a month, whatever. I got a call from Harvey or Ralph Carney, I forget, saying, hey, we're looking for another writer. And I go, oh, man, I do not want to have anything to do with the band anymore. I've just, I'm licking my wounds from the kidney fiasco. And, go down to the basement and I learn one of those songs. They learn one of mine. That's pretty cool. And then I, little by little, it became obvious that this is my tribe and I should be with these people. And then I had a fanzine and I began to send the fanzine to Robert Christgau. And Robert Christgau took some of my letters and talked to his editor. And I want to come to Akron and do a story on a. Because this was the time when regional stuff was like Madison, Wisconsin, and Athens, Georgia, and Austin to some degree. Everybody tries to find an interesting thing to write about and a hook. And if it's regional, well, get a letter. Big Rock Critic's coming. Can you guys put on a show? Sure, in a week. Oh my god! Oh my god! Oh my god! Scramble, find a venue, get openers, cobble together the PA system. Get all this together. Tin Huey, I have to learn the repertoire. They got to learn mine. Get it together. Throw the show up.
Or was it the bank? Was the show at the bank?
No, at JB's.
At JB's.
Okay. So, get it all together. Rock Credit comes, has a great time. We take him to the New Era Cafe for Paprikash in Akron. he hangs around Kent for Jerry's Diner. Blah blah blah. A great time. Put him on the plane. Got it. Oh, it's fabulous. Okay. Wow, we sure did. Well, we won. We got it over, 2 weeks, 2 weeks later, gets a phone call. My friend Karen Berg from Warner Brothers Records would like to come out. You guys put out another show? She's coming next week. Oh, okay, mad scramble. Get her. Please, Joe. Joe being Joe Bujak. Good for the shit, Joe Bujak. Cool, buddy. You're a band, eh? You don't get like Joe Walsh. Joe Walsh, that fuck. He never called me. Never called me. All I did for him. Does he remember Joe Bujak? Does he remember Joe Bujak? No. That fuck never caused nothing, no play, no benefit, nothing. I pissed on him. Anyway, Joe.
And James Gang was playing all the teen hops and everything
when we were coming up.
Yeah.
Right, and JB's.
Right.
So we begged Joe, give us the room, cobble together PA, three people's PA, all, mismatched impedances, whatever. Get another band's open, big rock A&R Woman's coming. And I had contacted Karen Berg earlier and sent her the Numbers Band record because she had signed Television. And there were similarities between the improvisational modal scales that Television used, and the Albert Eiler references and the Coltrane references, and similar to what the Numbers Band were doing, although the source for these were completely different. I mean, TV was very much, you know, Velvets and kind of garage rocky stuff, and mixed with very sophisticated musicianship. And as I've told you, the Numbers Band was very much blues based, Chicago blues based, or Delta blues based. There was no blues in Television.
Right.
Okay.
So Karen Burke comes
in. Karen Burke
to town.
Comes in. We put on the show, and it's a great show. I have a great time, and she's impressed. We collapse over in the corner and go, well, that's done. All right. You know, yeah, right. 2 weeks later, phone call. Ring, ring, ring. Hi, this is Karen Burke. I'd like to bring my boss, Jerry Wexler. Can you guys put on a show? He's coming next week. We're coming next week. Oh, fuck. Joe Buchak, please. Please, can we have the room? What? Good for shit. You going to remember me? No, you don't remember. You don't remember fucking Joe, but you good for shit. You know, yeah, he gave us the room. Yeah, we postered it. Yeah, we got the cobble together the PA system again. Put on a show. Jerry Wexler likes us. Jerry Wexler signs us. That was our downfall. We should have stayed an unsigned band.
Why?
Because in 1979...
I mean, there's nothing going on. You know, forgive my ignorance, my youth in those days, but to be signed to a major label was like every garage band's dream, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, well, sometimes the best thing that you think can happen is because the worst thing that can happen.
Of course.
You have to understand that there was this amazing bubble, rumors, record rumors by Fleetwood Mac, had filled the coffers, and they got to spend it so they don't have to give it to the government. So they said, we're going to sign 10 bands. Yeah, we're going to sign 10 American bands and do them as a lump and all this. And anyway, they put us in that pile. But like most people, they in the music business, they take a flyer. Now, 1 in 10, you know, succeeds, kind of. Maybe 1 in 20, huge. We didn't know what the fuck we were doing. I mean, we didn't have a manager. We didn't have this, you know. Anyway, we got this opportunity, and we tried to run with it. And sometimes you find an audience, and sometimes you don't. We didn't.
But the music stands the test
of
time.
Well, the music's pretty cool. That is true. I mean, we're not the first person I think made a decent record and not find an audience for it. And the songs still work live, so we play most of Contents Dislodged live at the shows. By the way, yeah, you know, I'm saying live because... 2 or 3 years ago, Ralph Carney blew into town and said...
Now, Ralph is a sax player.
Ralph is a sax player.
Ralph from Tom Waits.
Right.
He lives in the Bay Area.
Right. Lives in the Bay Area. He said, hey, I'm putting out a record. I need somebody to back me up for a show in Cleveland. Any of the Tin Hueys lying around want to do this? And so a couple, three did, and it was a lot of fun. And then he said, well, why don't we just reform and, you know, why don't we all back Ralph on a bigger show for something else? And then magic happened. So, like, now we love each other again.
But the story doesn't end there because you moved.
Yeah, yeah.
You moved
to
New York.
Well, Warner Brothers gave us money to go away.
Yeah.
Warner Brothers gave us money to go away. Their first offer was $25,000. I go, a lot of money. Except we're from the Midwest. We're like hardworking, honorable boys. We look at this contract here. It says two records. Well, we want to make that second record, you know. So, okay, we'll give you $35,000. No. You don't understand. We're hardworking Ohio kids. We're not that smart, you know. But it seems like a deal's a deal. We want to make that second record. All right, we'll give you $50,000. Yeah. Okay. Fine. Bye. Give me the check. So we took it. We divided our pie, divided up, paid our bills. Sold some gear. I moved to New York City. Ralph Carney moved to Brooklyn. Mostly the Hueys moved upstate. And I had a bunch of songs, one of them which was called I Know What Boys Like. And I began to hang out in New York in 70. I moved to New York City in October 79. And it was a great, great, fun, fabulous, new wavy time. And
God, the music was just...
Oh, gosh, it was fun. And it was coming out of the streets and Danceteria and CBGB was still roaring along and Tier 3 and Max's
Hurrah
Kansas
Club,
City
Mutt
and
Club.
Hurrah. Tin Hue had just about been very popular there. Thank you. Kudos to Jim Ferrat, who booked a lot of these places and gave everybody a shot.
I got to get Jim on the show.
Jim Ferrell would be fascinating.
He's just such a great rock and roll historian.
Oh yeah, yeah, and he's huge set of ears, just great, you know, and really took the crap because you know clubs in the New York area, owned by not necessarily the most upright citizens, and he was managed to, you know, walk that line and start up a bunch of really famous clubs and make sure people got paid and people didn't get hurt, you know, or whatever.
And the gear worked, and the PA.
Yeah, the gear worked.
Good.
PA was good, right? Yeah, all the things that one takes for granted, maybe in other parts of the country, but that's like just the idea of having a PA system that functioned well.
Doesn't have a blown tweeter.
They have a blown thing. Bang.
The
no
mics work.
Yeah, mics work. They don't. They may taste a little and smell a little scummy, but the pop filters definitely had, you know, somebody was chewing tobacco or whatever before you, but in the opening band. But no, that was great stuff. Yeah.
So you had a satchel full of songs. And
I
you were in New York City,
songs,
and you're like just like a kid in a candy store.
That's it. I thought, oh, this is fabulous. And at the time, dance music was not defined as we have dance music now. If there was hip-hop-ish, it was played live on real instruments, kids, no computers, except maybe Fairlight CMRI, computer musical instrument. 8-bit, right. 8-bit. The gatekeeper, and dance music was the B-52s, Tainted Love, Dancing by Myself by a Billy Idol, a.k.a. Chelsea, right? Chelsea X.
Generation X.
Generation X, okay. Yep. That's what dance music was, and the gatekeeper,
Gang of Four,
yeah. Right, and pop group, and you know, truly exotic,
really,
you know,
yeah, and then all the New York bands, the Rabies, the Contortions,
yes, Rabies, Contortions, exactly. The gatekeeper, of course, was the DJ, hey, Mr. DJ, somebody. Oh, at the same time, right, Paradise Garage, Madonna's dancing every night, right, and she's making nice with Jelly Bean Benitez, who's...
Well, that's a little bit, a couple years after you.
Was it after?
Yeah, okay, just a few years. That's the early 80s, like 82.
Okay, yeah. All right.
81, 82.
70, bang, boom. Also, parallel to that, and another great reason for moving was the loft jazz scene. Loft jazz was totally experimental. Somebody would have a loft, Soho, maybe, Brooklyn, maybe. You'd pay $5, you'd get a, you know, they give you a paper cup of beer, and there would be somebody really fantastic, like Dewey Redman or Henry Threadgill or you name it, playing in this basically this person's house. And or you would go to a performance, something new called performance art was going on. Again, $5 at the door, they give you a cup of beer, and you'd see some strange little girl named Laurie Anderson, you know, with her clothes half off, doing this amazing recital while playing a violin that didn't have that had a tape head on it, and you know, just great time. Loft jazz, performance art starting, rock and roll, sensational. Gatekeeper for all of this, for the music clubs, of course, was the DJ. I had an acetate of a version of I Know What Boys Like. I gave acetate being a rough vinyl copy. Usually one of a kind.
Isn't that weird that we have to be?
Yeah, have to explain.
You have
what
to explain
heck.
What acetate
yeah.
is.
Yeah,
but
it was
that's right.
It was a 12-inch 45 acetate. Gave it to this guy named Mark Kamens, who was a big shot DJ was it Danceteria? I think it was Peppermint Lounge.
Yeah.
Maybe the Pep.
One or the other. Well, we'd have to ask for Rob.
Anyway, he calls me the next day. He says he played it four times. It went over great. He took it up to A&R, his friends at Island Records. They want to meet. So I'm ushered into...
Now I got to ask you, Chris, on a personal level, are you a bit gun-shy after your Warner experience?
Or oh, hell yeah.
Are you like, you know, fuck the labels? Or are you thinking, well, now I know how to do it the right way?
Or the right way, and or I thought, I realized, you know, bands weren't going to make it and for me, and I thought, okay, if I have anything chops going, I'm a songwriter, and I went to New York to be a
publishing.
Songwriter. Yeah, I was going to try and get a publishing deal and all that. And they being Herb Korshak and Chris Blackwell and Kamens wound up saying, you know, Kamens was like, Kamens said, I'm a DJ, I want a job A&R, this is the kind of stuff I can find for you out on the street. And he played them voice like. Anyway, they said, this is great. We want to sign it. Where's your band? And we need a B-side. Well, it was, as I said, it was a fake band. They're back in Ohio. They're back in Ohio. Sure. Anyway, Patty, I think, had dropped out of college for the 20th time and was in Galveston or had come back. And I wired her my last $50. And she, I didn't know it, but she at the time was GF for Bob Bassone, brother of Danny Bassone, who now runs the Lime Spider, which is where we just played. It's just too fucking incestuous. Isn't it? Anyway, Patty comes. I grab some of the Contortion guys who are friends. Ralph Carney comes down. We record a B-side at Green Street, which is normally a hip-hop.
Right, recording studio, right?
Yeah, yeah. And they're the ones
who... It was Run DMC and all those
guys. Run DMC, you're exactly right. Green Street was like the shit. And that's where you learn to put like two or three bass drums together and tape them so you get this Canon enormous bottom going. Yeah. Right, right. Anyway, we do it there. And I don't know, it just keeps going. We wound up on Polygram, played a lot of shows, and it ran its course after 3.5 years.
Now, that must have made... You very happy as a songwriter for publishing on that.
Very happy as a songwriter, miserable as a guy in a band. I was back in a friggin' band again.
And you had to do all the shit.
I had to do all the shit because being in a band is no friggin' fun, especially when you're an old fart. You know, and I was already at 30, I was an old fart. You know, and you know, you put them in a van, deprive them of sleep, give them bad food, run them around the country, sometimes give them a white powder that makes you even more cranky. And this is a definition of fun. You know, you wonder why bands break up. No, forget it. It didn't work for me. As a writer, it was great to have a venue. But as a human, it was no fun.
Now, how did you manage to infiltrate the Z Records subdivision or division?
Well, all right. Island releases this single, I Know What Boys Like, back with No Guilt, on their Antilles label. ZE was originally going to... It's so complicated. ZE was distributed by Island. You know, I'm sure I got this wrong. Then they released I Know What Boys Like on ZE. They think about, gee, maybe we should make a record. An album. ZE, first it's going to be on Island. Then I get traded to ZE. We make our record. ZE, distributed by WEA, loses its distribution. So our record's on the shelf. We had like 9 months or 6 months, whatever, just touring. On the strength of I Know What Boys Like as a single, thank God it did not die. It just kept popping up and it hit a plateau. Finally, you know, no distribution. Karen Berg calls. Karen Berg calls Jerry Jaffe at Polygram, says, I can't do anything with this band, but Chris Butler has a new project called The Waitresses. Can you do something with it? Jerry Jaffe says, yeah. A&R guy, his boss being Chip Taylor, a.k.a. Chip Voigt, John Voigt's brother, Chip Taylor, who wrote Wild Thing.
For the trials.
So they signed us up. You know, we got farmed from ZE over there. And so we, that's how we wound up on that. And ZE was bizarre because most of the people in the band were from the Midwest, you know, and we still smell like manure. And ZE was this ultra chic dance,
Euro dance,
Euro trash, Euro dance, you know, I mean, they did a lot of fine American stuff, don't get me wrong, but the vibe on the label
Did Kid Creole and the
Big
Coconuts.
Money, Kid Creole was not was.
Yeah.
You know, good stuff. You know, I'm not knocking the artist, but the vibe was we are chic. You know, I mean, you know,
you're saying you guys were a little too provincial for
we
the label.
We were hicks. Yeah, and I was not a very good hustler. August Darnell would, you know, hit Michael Zilka up for fortune, and I would go in and say, I need $500 so we can get a band so we can go play Minnesota, and Michael would say, I don't have it. It all went to August. So August, you know, hats off to August Darnell. Because he really knew how to
Because he knew how to dress.
He knew how to dress. You know, he's right. Yeah, he knew how to dress.
He knew how to dress, and he had the classiest dames. Classiest the coconuts, dames. Man. Coconuts. Always good looking. Mm-mm-mm. Yeah. So, Christmas wrapping.
Oh, yeah. So
how could you forget that? That was just as massive. Was that a bigger record than I Know What Boys Like?
Yeah.
It still is to this
still
day.
Still is to this day.
Yeah. I mean, that must be a nice payday.
That's a nice payday.
How do you snake around that publishing and find out?
I owned it.
You owned it all, free and clear. So
I kept it. Yeah, I did some publishing deals in the
that was smart.
80s and 90s, but it was only for administration. And now I have a very good administrator, which is very nice. All right, kids out there, no matter what you do, don't sell your gear. Because it will appreciate. Keep your songs.
People are telling you, you got a good song, keep it.
Yes. Do not sell your publishing. Yeah. Yes, you may license. Yes, you may, do an administration deal. But if it's to your advantage, do it 2 years, 3 years, 5 years max. Everything has got to revert. Hold on to your publishing. Okay, so Waitresses are out doing what we're doing. Our record's in the can. Michael Zilka comes along, bless his heart, and says, "Oh, Chris, I've got a wonderful idea. I shall take all my twisted and bent artists, but we shall make a Christmas album. A Christmas album, and we're tired, and we don't have time for this, and I don't have any more song ideas, and I'm strapped, and we just hope that he'll change his mind." And I took a bit of, but he didn't, of course, and he books us into a studio, and I cobbled together something for little bits from this part of a half done song, and I'm literally finishing the lyric on the way over and to Electric Lady in the cab. And we do it in 2 days, then it's not bad, but we forgot about it. We just, who cares?
Yeah, but you guys were one of the first white bands to embrace rap.
Well,
and that's kind of culturally important.
Well, it was a joke because Curtis Blow had done something.
No, but I say the first white band.
Christmas rapping. Oh, okay.
You know what I'm saying? It's like you guys were white bread doing hip hop, which was come on. Yeah. Who did it? Blondie did it.
Yeah,
but Blondie, you guys, did you guys predate Blondie?
I don't know. I think Rapture Beat was ahead. But she had.
Well, in any event,
she had better street cred.
There was maybe
from the Midwest. We smell like manure. What do we know from rap?
This is Akron doesn't. You smell like rubber.
Come on. Like rubber.
Well, what manure in
Ohio?
Akron.
We all got pigs and chickens. Anyway, so we recorded. We forgot about it. And I we're out on the road again. Waiting for our damn record to come out in February now or whatever. And I call home, and my girlfriend says, "Hey, man, you're all over the radio." I go, finally, I Know What Boys Like broke through. That's great. This is November. He goes, no, your Christmas song. Your Christmas song is all over the radio. So who knew? Merry Christmas. And it's been a Merry Christmas ever since, which is fabulous.
But you're still wildly inventive, Chris.
Thanks
wildly
very much. Inventive.
I mean, you did a record a couple of years ago. Explain it. You used old technique.
Yeah.
I think this is a really fascinating story, by the way. I don't know too many people that... Some of the critics latched onto it, but share this. I mean, this is a really, really clever thing.
I sold some and I got some good ink. Well, at the time, Oh Brother, We're Out Though was out, and it was a very big T-Bone Burnett, Grammy Award-winning thing. He took old songs and re-recorded them in newer technology. I did the flip. I wrote a batch of songs and I record them on old technology, whichever I thought more or less kind of suited the song and its genre. For example, you can't go any further back than Edison. Well, I was able to find somebody who was an expert on Edison recording techniques and who had all the gear, and so I did wax cylinder recordings of a couple of songs. At a flea market, I found a machine that looked very much like a tape recorder, except looked like it was running fishing line. Well, that's exactly what it was. It's called a wire recorder, and it dated from the technology dates from the early 30s, commercially available mid 30s, picked up much more during World War II, commercially available again late 40s, early 50s, before it was tape. Anyway, this machine's amazing, and it worked. So now I've got this, an Edison cylinder and a scratchy recording. A wire machine, and little by little I began to meet other people and investigate other formats. Found an old tape recorder, first one commercially available in America, called a Brush Sound Mirror, BK-401, I believe is the. Anyway, 1946, made in Cleveland, Ohio. Found one of those, got it to work. Gradually, I began to build up a pile of tracks using as much old technology as I could find. Then one day, a friend calls and says, hey, there's this big old truck sitting up in Weehawken. You should go take a look at it. It looks familiar. Well, it sure did look familiar because it was the Rolling Stones mobile truck. It was the first studio on wheels that had somehow found its way in America. And it had two 16-track, 2-inch machines, a Helios console. Oh, this is all geek stuff, but if I said...
No, this is cherry stuff.
If I said 16-track, 2-inch with a Helios console, there's an engineer is listening out there, they have just come in their pants. All Neumann mics, all mil-spec British stuff. Fabulous, fabulous, fabulous equipment. And it's for rent. And it's cheap because nobody wants it because it's a dud format. Ha ha, in the digital age. There's nothing that sounds as good as 2-inch tape running 30 amps at 60 or 15 at 16 tracks.
Hallelujah.
I rent the truck. They get it for 3 days for like, you know, $1,000 plus engineer plus setup. It's fabulous. We did 4 songs plus a bunch of Joe covers. You know, so pretty soon I've got a collection of stuff and I call it Museum of Me. And I put it out as a kind of history lesson.
And the irony
recording.
Is you release it in the digital domain that compromises the sound.
Yes. The irony is that it, on one hand, it's in the age
historical.
Of pure, clear audio, it's a collection of tape hiss, scratchiness, crap, ticks, pops, whatever. Each one has got its own indigenous noise floor.
Right.
And then, in the end, it winds up, you know, on
compressing
a CD.
Compressing down on a signal. Yeah.
Right. It was really fun. Great. I got to use all kinds of great machines.
But, there. I mean, where can people get this CD?
You know, the usual places, CD Baby, Amazon.com, off my website, FutureFossilMusic.com.
FutureFossilMusic.com. FutureFossilMusic.
And or go to tinhuey.com and there's links, or my blog, Jammed On at Blogspot.
It's all right here in the digital age.
It's all in the digital domain. There you go.
Yeah, man. Yeah. It's a global world.
You know, I'm still eating off and I'm having fun. I'm doing nutty projects. I got myself in the Guinness Book of World Records.
Oh, yeah.
World's longest.
That's right. I forgot about that.
World's longest pop song. I think they retired the category.
Yeah.
Well, I wrote a song that had like a 12 phrase repeat at the end, and it was breakdown, and then he just repeats. Sometimes you can fix something by and with a different tagline in each one. And I was playing it for a friend, and I was embarrassed saying, I was thinking Velvet Underground, grind, and yeah, I should probably edit down to like 8 or 4 repeats or something. And I don't remember whether he said it or I said it, but we both were laughing. What if it just kept on going? What if it just repeated? And the idea, I think my usual test, if I tell somebody something and I get a laugh, or I get a chuckle, then it's like, oh yeah, I got to do it then. Well, how the hell do you write a song that just keeps going? And I had to learn how to do it, but it took a year and a half and over 600 different verses edited down to roughly 500 reused. The original cut on this thing was 82 minutes long. I had to cut it down to 69 because I wanted to also have a 5-minute version of what the original song was.
Right.
Got 14 different people to play on it. I gave them my vocal track, and they provided a backing track, including my mom, who plays prepared piano.
William
Sternberg sent tapes around the world, glued it all together on a computer, then had to wait until the technology caught up to be able to handle something that big, which was great because that worked to my advantage because I got to work on it some more. And when it was done, I sent a copy to Guinness and said, I think I did this. And they go, yeah, we think you did too, but you've got to back it up. So I had to do the research. I had to go talk to musicologists. I got together my evidence.
You had to find out whether or not it was indeed the longest piece.
Yeah, yeah, because you had to define what it was.
Well,
okay,
who has the second longest piece? Then?
What's his name? Michael Hall. 20 some minutes, something like that. Somebody's Dream. It's Michael Hall, guy from Austin, Texas.
From the True Believers, Michael Hall.
Could be.
Yeah.
Could be.
Yeah, I remember.
Okay, but you know what? It's also a lot. There's a difference between a song and a song with improvisation.
With a jam, right.
And a jam. There's
so
also a difference
verse,
between
chorus, verse.
Or it's got a verse definition. In America, the definition of a song is lyric with melody. Lyric with melody. Therefore, if I told you without a doubt, the longest song is probably either whatever that Mahabharata, the Indian creation myth that goes on for 8 days,
right.
But it's sung. The Odyssey and the Iliad are songs.
Wow.
Okay, but nobody knows the melody.
Right.
Nobody remembers how to go. All right. And are there any recordings of somebody singing?
Right.
These are the things I had to find. I had to say, okay, this could be a long song, except it's not recorded yet, and or nobody remembers what the melody is.
So then you define your category.
I define my category. Longest commercial,
recorded
pop song. Longest recorded pop song.
Right.
Right.
Fabulous.
And then people's logical answer was, Alice's Restaurant, which pales. Pales. A mirror.
Yeah, that's just pop. verse,
yeah.
verse.
Well, it's great, but it's, great at the time, but it's either 14 minutes or 19 minutes, something like that. Yeah. 19 minutes, I think.
You'd probably have to go. You'd really have to go to like a Bob Dylan, Sad Eye Lady of the Lowlands.
There you go.
There you go. That qualifies.
Right, that qualifies. Yeah. Yeah, you know what? Beat his pants off, too.
Is that grand?
Isn't that grand?
Yeah, that's great.
Well, dubious achievement, but. Yeah, lots of stuff to do, hopefully I won't drop dead before I get them all done, this is just a fabulous time of my life. I mean, I have a little dough. I'm, thankfully my songs keep generating a little dough. I don't need to be stinking wealthy.
You're a working artist.
I'm trying. I want to be a working artist. I want to keep going with these crazy fun stuff, and I seem to do no harm, so...
Now we just got to get you into Camp Devo so you can do some kids shows.
God.
Have those guys done?
Oh, that was one of the most. That is the brilliant. They are so smart. They are so fucking smart.
Mark has done very well with that Rugrats and the whole world.
Just the idea of we're too old. We don't want to tour. We're gonna audition a bunch of kids, do a version 2 of ourselves. Get Disney to back it. Get Disney to put it on the road. And
that is classy. Devo, it's Devo Point 2.
Devo, 2.0, right.
2.0.
Yeah, 2.0, right. Devo 2.0.
Classic. Maybe you should do that with the waitresses.
I thought about it. No, scooped again by Devo, sorry. Way ahead of the curve.
Damn, that Akron crowd, man.
Yeah.
Too clever.
Too clever.
Yeah. You got to stay ahead. It's not staying ahead of the New York crowd, Chris. It's staying ahead of the Akron crowd, man.
I'm the rogue leaders. Hey, man.
Anyway, thanks for being on the Culture Catch. And we'll look for more.
Thanks for catching me.
Yeah, man. More Chris Butler and Santa T.
I ain't dead yet.
Converge.
I know what boys like. I know what guys want. I know what boys like. I got what boys like. I know what boys like. I know what guys want. I see them looking. I make them want me. Touch me, I never let them. I know what boys like, I know what guys want. I know what boys like, boys like, boys like me. But you're special, I might get you. You're so much different, I might get you.
You've been listening to the two-part interview with Mr. Chris Butler from The Waitresses. If you'd like to catch part one with his exploding song,
just check us out at culturecatch.com. Type in the search engine Chris Butler and you'll find it. I'd like to thank today's sponsor, Ultimate Ears, for the best earbud technology. Use the earbuds the pros use. Use Ultimate Ears. UltimateEars.com. This is Dusty Wright for the Culture Catch. We'll see you soon. Culture Catch.